This is Dr. Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the American Counseling Association's 2014 podcast series. Today we are speaking with Antoinette Corvazzi regarding grief and complicated grief reaction. Antoinette is a licensed professional counselor and a nationally certified counselor licensed in Washington, D.C. Through her experience and training, she has developed specializations in grief and loss, trauma, and couples and family work. During her years with a local hospice as a grief counselor for the inpatient unit, she pursued her certification in thanatology, the study of death education, through the Association for Death Education and Counseling. She is also a certified compassionate bereavement care provider through MISS Foundation. Her busy private practice involves helping individuals and couples who have experienced traumatic loss, death of a child, sudden death, suicide, and homicide. Her clients include those who struggle through normal grief reactions associated with the death of a loved one, as well as those dealing with complicated grief reactions. Welcome, Antoinette.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Okay, I'm going to jump into the questions. The first question is, what does it mean to heal from loss?
Well, I think sometimes people think you actually get over it or, like it goes away, you get over it. And that is not anywhere near the truth. I believe that you never really get over it. Mm. But the way that I describe it is it changes. So the intensity changes. So the pain that one feels in the beginning of the loss, as they move through the healing process, that will change. Alan Wolfelt, who's the author of a book called Understanding Your Grief, he states, quote, "To heal in grief is to become whole again, to integrate your grief into yourself, and to learn to continue your life with fullness and meaning." And so that is basically what I tell my clients, that you integrate this loss into the rest of your life. It becomes part of your experience, like other experiences that we have in life. It's also important to stress the fact that, you know, we really don't want to forget or get over it, because the person, the deceased, is somebody that we love. And we want to remember them. So the relationship changes in the way it becomes a relationship of memories of that person. And the idea is to continue the bond. It's not to, how else can I say it other than really that? I mean, the idea is really we want to stay connected. We want to continue that bond. So I guess an easy way to put it after all that is basically that it does change.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there a difference between grieving and mourning? And if so, what is it?
Yes, there is a difference. And a very important difference, because grieving is what goes on inside of us. It's the pain that we feel. So when we lose somebody we love to death, of course, we're feeling a lot of different emotions, the pain of it. But a mourning is the outward expression of that pain. And the reason it's important to distinguish between those two things is that the healing comes from the mourning, the outward expression of the pain. So for people to be able to talk about their loss and to share all their feelings and their thoughts about that person is where the healing comes in. And so when we counsel people, that's what we're doing with them. We're giving them the space, the safe space, to be able to do all of that work.
I was wondering, as you said that, I kind of had an image of a grief I've seen in other countries, and I was just wondering, is it something that is mourning something that's done very differently in different cultures?
I would imagine yes. You know, offhand, I can't really think of an example of how one culture might grieve or mourn differently than another. But I think the first thought that comes to me, being that I'm Italian, mm-hmm. that when I think about Italians, that we are people who find it pretty easy to be able to express our feelings. So mm-hmm. I can talk specifically for me. Growing up in my home, I saw people mourn outwardly. Mm-hmm. They would talk about their feelings. They would cry. They would share things. They would grieve together. Mm-hmm. And I remember sometimes going to wakes or funerals and seeing that some people were very reserved, mm-hmm. And they didn't do it quite the same way. So I think it's also important to stress the fact that there is no right or wrong way to mourn, mm-hmm. that people do it in their own way and in their own time.
Yeah. I lived in Korea and Japan for a while working for the Army. And in Korea, we would see people, you know, just screaming and falling on the floor. And it was very, very different from what I was used to in America.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, culture definitely has a lot to do with it. Mm-hmm. You know, Alan Wolfelt, again, you know, I mentioned him. He actually uses the word intention, and he says that we have to set our intention to heal. Mm. So he makes a distinction between being a passive participant versus an active participant mm-hmm. In this process. And so however we might do it, you know, we have to do it ourselves and just realize that there's a difference between being kind of passive or denying us that opportunity to mourn. But again, you know, people do it differently, and I do want to stress the fact that there isn't a right way or a wrong way to do it.
There are some people who feel profoundly affected by the loss of, say, their mother, their father, a family member, and they talk about it a lot, and they seem depressed for a very long time, and then there are other people who just say, you know, death is part of life, and they appear to be getting over it relatively quick. What are the differences between these two types of people?
We'll say that again just a little bit more. So you're saying, like, okay. Two people could lose, let's say, a parent and
yes.
deal with it very differently?
Right. One is talking about it all the time, you know, at work, say a friend at work, or they're talking about it all the time, and they're in a lot of pain about it, and the other person seems to be moving on rather quickly. What is that about, the difference that we see?
Well, tell me if I don't answer your question. The way I'm hearing it is that people have different relationships, right? So I could have a relationship with my mother that's very different from the relationship that you have with mm-hmm. your mother. So I think a lot of it has to do with the relationship. So you can't really compare them. Mm-hmm. Just because they're both a mother or a grandmother or a sister or a brother, I think there are a lot of things that come into play when you think about how one person might grieve versus the other. For example, there could also be in a relationship with a parent some real mixed feelings about that relationship mm-hmm. or what was going on in that relationship, which could contribute to somebody dealing, you know, with their grief differently. Mm-hmm. Some people might have, you know, regrets or unfinished business. So I think there's a lot to think about and a lot to consider mm-hmm. When we think about how differently people grieve.
Yeah. People talk about the mourning process. What is meant by the mourning process?
Well, I'll use William Warden. He refers to the mourning process by saying tasks of mourning. So that's how he describes it. And mourning is a process. So just to give you an example of how he describes that, task number one is to accept the reality of the loss. Task number two is to work through the pain of grief. And three is to adjust to an environment in which the deceased is missing. And number four is to emotionally relocate the deceased and move on with life. So if we look at task number one, warden's task number one, which is to accept the reality of the loss, when someone dies, I think, in my experience, I've noticed that although intellectually we know that person is dead, mm-hmm. it still takes a while to absorb it. And so I find people will say it in a session. They'll just say, I know my loved one is dead, but it's still hard to believe. It's still mm-hmm. really hard for me mm-hmm. to believe it. It's almost like they have to keep saying it to make it real in a way. Mm-hmm. And what I also find is I notice that people understand this intellectually, mm-hmm. but I feel like the emotional part takes a little while to catch up.
Yeah.
So that's how I would describe task number one, to accept the reality of the loss.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's moving through this, okay? So task number two would be to work through the pain of grief.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, grief is physical and emotional. And Alan Wolfelt uses the words to honor your pain, which is what I was talking about earlier, mm-hmm. that one must face the pain, deal with all of these feelings and emotions. And that's basically what William Warden is talking about when he talks about task number two, to work through the pain. And task three, he says, is to adjust to an environment in which the deceased is missing.
Mm.
He says there are three areas of adjustment. First one is external, how the death affects one's everyday functioning in the world. For example, someone now is living alone, raising children alone, facing an empty house, taking care of the finances. Those are some of the examples that he uses to explain the external adjustment. Number two, he says, is the internal adjustments. How the death affects one's sense of self. How does the death affect self-definition, self-esteem, and sense of self-efficacy? And three is spiritual adjustment, how the death affects one's belief, values, assumptions about the world. So those are how he explains, task number three. And then task number four is emotionally relocate the deceased and move on with life. Sometimes I find people have a little bit of a hard time with this one because, again, it might appear like you need to forget about your loved one. And, again, that's not true. So what it really means is, how does one find a way to stay connected to the deceased,
mm-hmm.
but yet allow themselves to go on living their lives, to be able to have another relationship if it's the death of a spouse. So that's how he describes the tasks of mourning. So it's really a process, and it's broken down that way because it is a process, and it does take time. So there's no reward for speed. I mean, people really have to just allow themselves to go through this process. And I do want to also stress that, there's really one way when it comes to grief to get to the other side, and that's by going through it. So sometimes people try to go around it, but when people try to go around it or avoid going through this process, then we're talking about something else, which, you know, could bring up complications. And so, mm-hmm. you know, that's when we'll talk about complicated grief. And there is something else that I want to stress. It's been said that it's not just the passing of time, but what you do with that time, which leads to one's healing. And so, you know, that's what this means pretty much is when you talk about what you do with the time versus just the passing of time, again, you're allowing yourself to mourn. Mm-hmm. And that is just so important to get to the other side.
The next question is one that probably people ask you, probably your clients ask you this. Do I ever get over the loss of a loved one?
What I tell them is that, in my opinion, you don't get over it. It just changes. And that it's not, the pain is not as intense. So for me, I think you heal in the way that I described, which is by allowing yourself to heal by feeling all these feelings, and then you get to a different place. But I also find and believe that sometimes feelings come up or, you know, things get triggered. There's something Alan Wolfelt talks about, which is grief bursts. I love that word. I think it's just such a great way of describing what happens sometimes when we could be driving in our car, we could hear a song, we could be in a supermarket, we could just remember something that our loved one liked to eat, whatever the case might be, and we're just overcome with emotion. And he actually has this phrase that he uses, grief bursts. And so I think that that can just happen throughout one's life. I know from my own experience that, you know, I might be going along and everything seems like a regular day and, you know, I'm not thinking of anything. And then something could happen and I might think of my loved one who died. And, you know, I feel sad. So when somebody says, do you ever get over it, I think it really depends on how you define that. For me, I think you heal, as I said earlier, by integrating this into the rest of your life.
Now I want to ask you some questions about the different kinds of grief. For example, what is anticipatory grief?
Anticipatory grief, a good way to describe that is when we know our loved one is dying. For example, a diagnosis of a terminal illness and someone is given a certain amount of time to live. We basically start grieving when we get that notice, when we hear our loved one only has a certain amount of time to live, we know that they're going to die, we're anticipating this death. And so that's really what it means. Now, a question comes up, what I've heard from people is if it's anticipatory grief, that in some ways it's easier because you expect it or you know it's coming. And I'm not 100% in agreement with that. I think it's more complicated than that, and we don't really know how somebody might feel or react, even if they knew their loved one is dying. What I will say about it, which I think is very, very important and makes a difference sometimes when people are grieving, which is they have time with their loved one to be able to talk about things, to tell their loved one they love them, they forgive them, talk about their wishes, whatever it might be. It gives them an opportunity to be able to do these things. And I think, you know, there's something about that which is different, obviously, when there's a sudden death, you know, an unexpected death. The survivor, the family member, the friend, whomever it is, doesn't really have the opportunity to make peace in some ways or to talk about things, as I said, whether it's unfinished business or something else they just want to share. So I think that the way they might mourn, I think that definitely could make a big difference.
When you worked at hospice, I'm assuming you dealt with a lot of anticipatory grief. And so tell us a little about how you might work with a family or a family member who is having a particularly difficult time with their anticipatory grief.
Well, it's really about allowing them the space to feel safe and to be able to express it. So I don't think there's that much of a difference between someone who's grieving after the death and the person who's grieving when they find out that their loved one is dying. I think I give them the same amount of room and space to do that. So at hospice, what was nice about hospice is that I was the grief counselor for the inpatient unit. So as you can imagine, I mean, in the inpatient unit, people were dying. And so the loved ones would be there with them. And they had the opportunity to speak to a grief counselor beforehand while they were going through it. So they got the support before the death. And I think that in many ways that was comforting and helpful to them.
Yeah. What is traumatic loss, traumatic grief?
Well, as we can see, the word trauma is in there. So, you know, a situation that's deeply distressing. And examples of traumatic loss would be a sudden death, the death of a child, a suicide, a homicide. So those are examples of traumatic loss. And sometimes, you know, obviously they're... the grieving process, you know, might take longer, and they might need, you know, just even more support, because as you can imagine, it's a lot more complicated in some ways.
You mentioned loss of a child. I think for many of us, we can't imagine a worse thing. And particularly those of us who are parents, and even those who are not parents, we can't imagine a worse thing than the loss of a child. So is the grief counseling any different, say, when you're working with the mother and or father of a dying child?
It is in the way that there are different feelings involved. You're grieving, of course, you know, we don't expect this. It's not supposed to happen this way. So right there, it just kind of, you know, rocks our world. Like, this isn't, this isn't supposed to happen.
We're supposed to die first, the mom and dad.
And so that alone, and with that, comes a lot of things about, you know, the parents' hopes and dreams of the future.
Yeah.
So you're talking about the loss of the person, which, of course, you miss that person, and it's so painful. And I think, you know, parents obviously feel that they're supposed to take care of this child, to protect this child. So there's a lot around that And also, you know, as I said, these dreams of the future of this the child. So all of those dreams are now shattered.
Yeah.
Of, you know, watching the child grow up. They, you know, looking forward to them doing all sorts of things. The future. So it's also mourning the future.
Yes. Yes. We also hear a lot. I know I've heard it anecdotally. I don't know if I've actually read the statistics, but we hear that parents of children who die young often are unable to sustain their marriage subsequent to the death of the child. Is that true?
I don't know what the you know, the statistics are,
yeah,
on that, but I think that what they're saying is that there might be there might be some truth to maybe attaching to a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not 100% sure on that,
mm-hmm.
but I know what you're talking about. I think, you know, I've heard that too.
Yeah, they say there are a lot of divorces and or separations after a child dies that the parents have, and I think some of them might blame one another for something regarding the child's
right
early demise.
Well, that's, I think, what, you know, I was saying before, that
mm-hmm.
Parents feel that they you know, are supposed to be able to protect them no matter what, and
mm-hmm.
so in some ways feeling guilt, and that guilt is part of grief. That is part of how their grief is manifesting itself. And
mm-hmm.
I think that that's why counseling could be really helpful too, because it actually gives them an opportunity to be able to hear themselves say these things or talk about it.
Have you also seen children for grief counseling whose parents have died?
Yes,
mm-hmm.
I have. I have, and with young children, I mean, we deal with it a little differently,
mm-hmm.
And it's done, I'm sure you've heard, mostly through play, because they
mm-hmm.
don't express themselves the same way as adults do. I mean, adults
mm-hmm.
can sit there and talk and express their feelings, and children aren't quite as good at doing
right.
that. So we'll, you know, so we'll use different ways of play to
mm-hmm.
To be able, so that they're able to express themselves
mm-hmm.
in that way. You know, and then a little older adolescents, you know, they can, you know, I'm thinking specifically, you know, with some that I've worked with, and they're
mm-hmm.
able to talk about things. But, you know, I think it's really helpful because sometimes, in my experience, they might be angry for some reason
mm-hmm.
with the parent, for example. For leaving them or not explaining enough to them. And then it's really hard for them because they feel guilty for being angry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just think about that. I'm thinking of working with children like that. And it can be very comforting for them to let
mm-hmm.
them know that, you know, just because you're angry, that doesn't mean that you don't love them or you don't care about them. So there's, you know, there's room for all these feelings, but
mm-hmm.
you can imagine if they're not, if they're holding this in because they feel guilty or they feel they can't express it. I don't, my heart goes out to them because
yeah.
It must be very painful, but they don't know any other way. And
mm-hmm.
so just my experience with them, just letting them know, even that word, reassuring them that, you know, it's okay to be angry, but that doesn't take away the love. That doesn't mean
mm-hmm.
that you don't love your parent. And there is room for those things. And talk about it. You know,
mm-hmm.
what are you angry about?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yes.
The next question, I think, is a big question because counselors deal with this, and that is, what is ambiguous loss?
Ambiguous loss is when there's a loss and it's not necessarily, you know, there's, for example, a body there. For example, it's when somebody is missing, So there might not be a body found. And so how difficult is that to be mourning or thinking you should mourn, but you're not ready to mourn? So it's sort of the mourning process gets a little delayed. And you know, there are other kinds of ambiguous loss, dementia or Alzheimer's, for example. The person is there, but they're not really there. So I mean, it's still a loss. But it's a completely different kind of a loss. There's a great book, if you really want to learn more about ambiguous loss, by Pauline Boss, B-O-S-S. Her book is Loss, Trauma, and Resilience, Therapeutic Work with Ambiguous Loss. And she really goes into a lot of detail about it and writes about it really, really well. And I would encourage anybody who wants to learn more about that to pick up her book.
We will put links to these books at the bottom of the podcast page, so people can go and get these books. So that's great. What about a loss where, let's say it's a loss of a parent who abused you. So your parent has died, but this was the parent who abused the child or abused the adult when they were a child. And how difficult is that to work through?
Well, yeah, that could be very difficult.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of feelings in that. So again, it's about really being able to make that safe space and allow that person to express all the feelings. But of course, then that could, you know, contribute to grief becoming complicated because it's a complicated relationship.
What is complicated grief? Can you define it for us and talk a little about it?
Sure. Complicated mourning, as William Warden calls it. I think the best way to describe it is what's different about it is the intensity and the duration of the grief. And there are different things that, different factors, of course, that could contribute to that. One of them is the relationship, which is what you just mentioned, actually, like a highly ambivalent relationship. So, yeah, you can imagine how that could contribute to your mourning process because how complicated that might be, you know, whether, you know, there's love there, there's anger, there's a lot of other feelings. So, so really being able to sort through all those feelings and allow yourself to feel them and talk about them. Another factor would be, you know, circumstantial, which is what we were talking about, the ambiguous, like the a body missing, the uncertainty of that. And that could really delay someone's process. Historical factors as well. People who had maybe complicated grief reactions in the past will have them in the future. And you know, one's personality. You know, knowing how they might have dealt with something in the past could affect how they deal with things in the future or present, and also social factors, which is one's support system. Of course, it's going to make a difference when somebody's mourning a loss if they have a lot of support and people that they can talk to about it, people they can grieve with, or just someone that will listen and understand. So these are all really important factors. And again, William Warden talks about them you know, in his book. Mm-hmm. Then he also describes, William Warden has four ways of describing complicated grief. The first one he talks about is chronic grief reactions. You know, the reaction is really intense, and it doesn't seem to subside.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what he means by this chronic grief reaction. And what happens usually is people are aware. So somebody will come in to counseling a lot of time because they feel that they're not moving through the process. They feel like something is going on for them, and they'll bring themselves into into counseling. And so it's a matter of, you know, really talking to them, doing the counseling, understanding what's keeping them stuck, what's keeping them from kind of moving in this process.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's delayed grief reactions, which he talks about.
Uh-huh.
And that's when someone may have had a reaction to the death, but it's not quite as intense as maybe it sort of doesn't match with this loss, for example. And so another way of describing it is where the grief is suppressed or postponed. And then something might happen, and there's this reaction to it that's a little out of, I could think of a better word if I thought about it, but a little out of whack with what they're reacting to. And it really has more to do with the fact that they haven't really allowed themselves to mourn the loss that's really going on for them. And then something else they see, which seems like, why would this person react this way to, let's say, a movie or something that they're watching on TV, but have a real intense reaction. And, and you know, the reality is that it really didn't have to do so much with the movie. But the movie maybe triggered this reaction in them. So.
Right. And isn't it also true, sometimes you'll see a client and they'll come in, let's say, a year after the death of, let's say, a spouse, and they'll say, you know, I've been dealing with everything having to do with my husband's death, including selling his business and doing this and doing that and helping this and that person. And finally, when all these tasks were done, they start to feel the grief themselves. It's postponed because they're busying themselves with all of the details, which in some cases are very complex.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of what you're talking about, I think, is a distraction from it. And they're focused on getting all these things done. And so they're not really able to grieve. What I found, too, when I was at hospice, a few times I would follow up with somebody after a death, and they would say, you know, they think that they're doing okay. That they feel like they're grieving and, you know, they're doing okay with this.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe 4 months later, I would get a call, like people saying, for example, I thought I was doing really well. I was doing really well, but I don't know what happened all of a sudden, you know.
Yeah.
And so, sometimes, you know, it takes a little while for people to really feel the intensity, or they're not allowing themselves. The other thing that I feel, or that I notice, is when we lose somebody too, I think our body goes in shock a little bit. And so we kind of, it's so overwhelming that we, the body protects itself and allows a little bit in at a time. So I don't think it's unusual for people to have a greater grief reaction a few months later, where people think that they'll see the intense grief reaction from the beginning, and that's not necessarily true.
Another complicated grief reaction that I've seen was a gentleman who I knew was telling me that he went with his brother to his father's funeral, and he said, it's like I didn't even know the person they were talking about, and because they were talking about what a great guy he was, and he wasn't that great to me and my brother when we were growing up. And I thought that was very interesting. Do you see that as well?
Yes, I've had experience with people, who come in and they say that. And that's it's really hard because the image that maybe other people had or saw of the deceased is a lot different than what their experience was. And again, it's really important to be able to talk about that because that could bring up some feelings of, betrayal.
Yes.
Anger.
Yes.
A lot of different feelings. And again, it's really important to be able to talk about that, especially feeling, betrayed or as if someone else was given something and they weren't given that. So feelings of, resentment, confusion, a lot of feelings could come up.
And, abused children, I've noticed, having counseled so many people over the years, people, they will be ambivalent. So they'll say, my mom was great. My dad was great. They were wonderful. And they also abused me,
Right.
So holding the tension of the opposites,
Yes.
This is not easy for people to do.
Right. Yeah. And, and again, sorting out those feelings and being able to really talk about it and what this experience was like for them. It's very personal and has a lot to do with what I mentioned earlier, that people's relationships are different. They're unique. They're as unique as we are as human beings. And I think it's really important to keep that in mind and to also, as therapists, as counselors, not let our feelings get in the way of this. Because if this person was abused, of course they have feelings about the abuse, but they have other feelings too. And we're interested in knowing what their feelings are, not what not what we think they should be.
Right. What might influence someone's failure to grieve?
The things that I mentioned before. It could be the relationship. How I had mentioned the ambivalence. So that would be a factor. Circumstantial, as I mentioned, if the body's missing, for example, it might get in the way of them grieving because they're not ready to grieve. They don't believe that their loved one is dead. They might think that they're still alive. So they don't want to grieve because that would mean giving up hope. And so some people, they're not ready to give up hope. And so that will delay the whole process of grieving. And sort of historical factors, as I mentioned also earlier. So if they've had complicated grief reactions in the past, they might have them again. Personality, it's hard for them to deal with the distress, and that might delay things a bit. One other thing, though, that I didn't mention and I'll mention is the disenfranchised grief. And that's when it's socially unacceptable to grieve.
Can you give us an example?
Sure. I hope things have changed now, but but AIDS, for example, would be one, a suicide. Would be another. Abortion would be another. Miscarriage, even the death of an ex-spouse. These are some of the things that, in our society, perhaps people, don't grieve outwardly because in our society it's sort of this unacceptable or people don't understand that someone could be grieving this kind of loss.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so that would be, that's an example of disenfranchised grief. And of course mm-hmm. that will delay or will not allow someone to grieve openly. And mm-hmm. so that could lead to complications.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
Mm-hmm. And we didn't mention two others, which is mm-hmm. Exaggerated grief reactions.
Mm-hmm.
And Warden describes it as exaggerated grief responses in which the person experiencing the intensification of a normal grief reaction feels either overwhelmed or resorts to maladaptive behavior. And then there's masked.
Like what? What kind of maladaptive behavior?
Well, for example, a psychiatric disorder could come, like clinical depression. Mm-hmm. A drug use, mm-hmm. Medicating, things
sure.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that type of thing. And in mass grief reaction, there's some of that that goes on, but in the exaggerated grief reaction, they know that it has something to do with the death. But mm-hmm. in a mass grief reaction, they don't realize that it has anything to do, with their loss, with their
mm-hmm.
grieving.
Mm-hmm.
So, and also in mass grief reactions, Warden talks about how it could be physical or maladaptive. It could manifest itself. So, sometimes people will get, stomach pain
mm-hmm.
Or something like that. So as we said, grief is, it is physical too. So it's not just emotional. So things like that.
People lose weight, gain weight, all kinds of things happen physically.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure. Eating is when a person is grieving,
mm-hmm.
Their sleep is affected, their
right.
eating is affected. A lot of things are affected. So,
Can you name and describe any other different complicated grief reactions?
Well, I would say it's basically, when I look at them, I think that William Warden is mm-hmm. very good at putting them in four categories.
Mm-hmm.
And just to go over them one more time,
mm-hmm.
Chronic grief, delayed grief, exaggerated grief, and masked grief
mm-hmm.
reactions. And I think he puts them in those four categories, and it pretty much covers the different kinds of complicated grief reactions.
Mm-hmm. So let's say you have a typical case of somebody who is having a strong grief reaction. Let's say somebody in their nuclear family has died, mother, father, and the client comes in and they are hesitant to get into it. How do you work with that client? What are things you might do in the beginning?
Well, I like to ask them if they're willing to share their story.
Okay.
So that's how I might start something. I think it's really helpful. And I'll say to them, tell me wherever you want to start.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to start from the diagnosis? Do you want to tell me about when you found out about the death, whatever, the illness, whatever it might be?
Mm-hmm.
And so I like to kind of open up the space, just give
mm-hmm.
them room to be able to talk about it. And
mm-hmm.
and when people start talking about it, things come up.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, obviously I really meet them where they are.
Mm-hmm. Like Carl Rogers. Yeah.
Yes. And what I find is that if people are ready and you provide that space, that safe space,
mm-hmm.
In their time, they will be able to share and to mourn You know, I've had people who maybe a year, year and a half later have come in, and they say that there's something, I'm here because I feel like I should be, you know, somewhere else. So they're maybe mm-hmm. noticing something. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's just that they're impatient.
Yes.
So I'm always listening to that. You know, if somebody comes and they say, you know, I feel like I should be, you know, farther along. Well, you know, I'll think about and I'll talk about, you know, what mm-hmm. is this urgency about?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just a discomfort with being where they are, and they mm-hmm. want to move through this. I've had people come in and say, please tell me what I need to do because I can't mm-hmm. stand this any longer, and mm-hmm. I want to just get through it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't work
that way. It doesn't work that way.
And
right.
So I just have to come out and say, no, mm-hmm. it doesn't work that way, and let's mm-hmm. see, you know, what's going on. You know, sometimes people think they're grieving just because, for example, they might be crying a lot. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there might be more to this than crying. I mean, have they really been able to express some of the feelings that might be keeping them in a certain place?
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, by being able to be there, to be supportive, to listen to them, to give them this safe place, to allow them to talk about all the feelings, not just mm-hmm. the good feelings. I think it's all a really big part of helping people mourn.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, have you done grief groups? And if so, how is that different?
I have done grief groups, and mm-hmm. I did many when I was with hospice.
Yeah.
I had, you know, open groups and closed groups.
Mm-hmm.
What I find is some people will say, I don't want the group.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to hear about other people's grief.
Mm-hmm.
I want to deal with this, but I want to do it individually. And then there mm-hmm. are some people who say, you know, a group is really helpful. I want to be with people who have experienced something similar to what I've experienced, and mm-hmm. they can support me, and I can hear about, you know, what it's like for them and what they're doing to help themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So it's different. I think there are some people that just want the individual, mm-hmm. and there are some people that really can benefit from group and want the group. And they usually make that decision.
Mm-hmm.
But groups, I find, with my experience of doing groups, it's been very helpful to people.
Mm-hmm.
They bond. Mm-hmm. They really support each other. A lot of times they would keep in touch after the group because they really, they got close. They connected.
Yeah.
You know, it's very intimate. You're sharing some really, really intimate feelings
mm-hmm.
And experience with other people. And there's something about being with people that really understand you know, what it feels like to lose somebody. And
mm-hmm.
they want to talk to those people. They want to be around those people. Because I've had people say sometimes, if someone hasn't experienced this kind of loss, like the mm-hmm. loss of somebody who's really close to you, that they feel like, you know, it's hard to talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And I found through doing groups with children, the children often thought they're the only ones who feel this way. And when they went to group, it was so healing, you know, for them to see, oh, I'm not the only one, you know.
Yes.
There are other people who are feeling like this, and they're living, and we don't die from this, and, you know.
The feeling of, yes, not being alone in this, because I think sometimes when people are grieving, they feel very
mm-hmm.
alone in their grief, and that's why you know, one of the things that I had also mentioned, you know, the social aspect of it is
mm-hmm.
Getting support You know, getting that support is very important. It's one of the questions that I will ask people when they come to me. I will say, tell me about your support. Tell me about your support system. Because that could make a really big difference. If somebody is isolated, if they have no one to share this with, to talk to support them, I think that that could lead to complicated grief.
Sure.
So so that aspect is very important.
Well, I'm going to ask you a last question, and this is really a wrap-up question. And that is that ACA currently has 55,000 plus members, most of whom are clinicians seeing clients all day, every day. Is there anything I have not asked you that you want our members to know?
Well, I'd like to stress the importance of, you know, again, that it's been said when it comes to grief that it's not just about the passing of time, but what you do with that time, which is really what we've been talking about, which is not just, you know, the difference between grieving and mourning, and that mourning is a process, and that that is where the healing comes in. I think, you know, we're talking right now at a time where the holidays are coming up also. And so just thinking about that, that sometimes people think there's a right way and a wrong way to deal with the holidays. And, you know, I'd like people to know that that's not true, that there is not a right way or a wrong way. It's about finding what works for you. Sometimes people during the holidays, they want to be around the same people, family. Sometimes they might want to be around a smaller crowd. They may want to go away or do something like that, but it's really a matter of figuring out what you feel you can handle and what you want to be around, and that things don't have to be exactly the same way, that things have changed. And it's okay to do something different if that's what you feel like doing during the holidays. To also be patient with yourself, I think, is really important. And to think about, you know, maybe this holiday you can't write out cards or buy, you know, 20 gifts. But to really think about that and to take care of yourself. And to be patient with yourself. I think those are really important things to keep in mind.
I'm so glad you brought up the holidays. I do find people, you know, wishing they could recapture the way the holiday was when this or that person was still with us. And yeah, there are new ways you can do holidays. And I love the idea of us all giving each other permission to do it completely different if we choose to do so.
Yes, I agree with that.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Antoinette Corvazzi, for discussing grief and mourning and complicated grief reaction with us today. To view links to this program, to write to the presenter or the host, please go to www.counseling.org and click on the podcast page. This is Dr. Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the ACA 2014 podcast series, signing off.